Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bites. Today we're talking about legal ethics and electronic discovery. Our guest today is Ralph Losey, and anyone who tracks either electronic discovery or ESI Bites knows who Ralph Losey is. He has one of the most widely read blogs in the industry. He's published a number of books through the American Bar Association. Most recent book that came out was Introduction to eDiscovery, New Cases, Ideas, and Techniques. There have been, what, four books, right, Ralph? I think four books.
No, just two books, although I've contributed to two others, two books that I wrote all the content, a couple others that I, you know, added a chapter.
Okay. And he's also a partner at the Florida-based Am Law 100 law firm, Ackerman Centerfit, where he chairs their electronic discovery practice. Ralph, great to have you back on our second show with us.
Oh, great to be here, Carl. Speaking with you and have the opportunity to get the message out there to as many people as possible about the importance of ethics in e-discovery particularly.
Yeah, this is a topic that really, the more you get into e-discovery, becomes apparent is just crying out for attention. And you've blogged about this topic before, and you recently gave a presentation at Mercer University with Judge Facciola, Jason Barron, Professor Monroe Freeman, and others on the ethics of electronic discovery. You know, tell me a little bit about that conference, which just focused on the ethics, and you know, if you want to start off with that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It was really quite an incredible, very well-run, good conference at Mercer, which is located just south of Atlanta in Macon, Georgia, a beautiful campus. And we had 2 days full seminar put on by the Law Review there. I believe it was the first academic seminar to address the issues of ethics in e-discovery, and also in there was some other presentations on ethics involved in online provision of legal services, that sort of thing. But the focus was on e-discovery. In fact, this first came up about a year ago, Carl, and that long in gestation. When I am reading all the cases that everybody else is that comes out in e-discovery, and there's just case after case where lawyers are being sanctioned and clients are being sanctioned, and frequently lawyers and clients are both being sanctioned. And the latest one is, you know, law firm alone being sanctioned, not the client, for all kinds of misconduct in e-discovery. And this seemed quite puzzling to me in that, you know, I've been a lawyer a long time, since 1980. And you didn't see many sanction cases in the 80s and 90s against lawyers. I mean, they would come up, but spoliation was a pretty rare thing. I got to wondering, you know, what is going on? Has the legal profession suddenly become less ethical? That nowadays in the 2000s, we're now behaving with a kind of a lower moral standards than we did in the 80s and the 90s? And you know, I was really trying to figure out why is it that there's so many sanction cases and that lawyers are being reprimanded and so often now, and particularly in the field of e-discovery. I mean, this is the field, I think, and nobody's ever challenged me on it, where you've got more sanction cases involving lawyers than any other field of law.
So, you know,
I found this quite puzzling.
If you say something like that enough times, it becomes true. People believe it.
Well, yeah, no, I would love to see another area of law that has more problems than we do in e-discovery, but I haven't seen it.
I won't challenge you on it, but why do you think this is growing? Because I don't disagree, honestly. But why do you think this area is growing with ethical issues?
Well, this was the puzzler, and so I started thinking about it. You know, this is a big problem, and it's not something that just happens overnight. And then I got an invitation from the dean at Mercer Law School, who said they were organizing this event. And you know, one of the good things about being a blogger is you're out there, and a lot of people kind of know about you. So they knew about me and said, you know, who else do you think would be good to invent? So I came up with some of my dream team people, and several of them were available, including Judge Facciola, Jason Barron, and then I also invited the person that I now co-teach eDiscovery at the University of Florida Law School, and that is Bill Hamilton. He came up there, and then we got Judge David Baker, who's a magistrate judge in Orlando, well known and rightfully so for his writing of the eDiscovery opinion on in regard to Seroquel. And also Judge Baker is the only person I know who's been messing with computers longer than I have. He goes back to the early and mid 70s, so he's a very much of a technophile. So we had this kind of dream team of people that were all, you know, we had months to prepare for this event and try and think out the whole question of ethics. Jason gave a presentation. The way it works is in an academic setting, you make a presentation and then the panel members sort of comment on it. And Jason made a very interesting presentation concerning ethics related to search, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with asymmetric knowledge, is the way he called it. In other words, when you represent a client as a lawyer over and over again, or if you're in-house counsel, you become very familiar with their information. And you know, basically, you have a much better idea of what's in their information, certainly than opposing counsel does. And what kind of ethical duties does that create to assist opposing counsel in their search for relevant information? And so this was the thesis that Jason explored and that was followed up upon by Judge Facciola, and that was a whole area of discussion. My area of discussion, though, got back to this puzzling question, and, you know, why are lawyers behaving badly? Kind of take off on the popular television show. I came up with this thing that I call the Wicked Quadrant, which is four different factors that I believe explain why it is that all of a sudden there are so many lawyers being sanctioned in the field of e-discovery. So I gave a presentation on that. I actually, in the meantime, I wrote a law review article further elaborating on my thoughts, and that's going to be published by Mercer Law Review, coming out right now for their spring edition. The other thing Mercer did, which is very fascinating, and I suggest you try and get a hold of this, the listeners that have a real interest in this, they made a transcript of the entire proceeding. So you can read Judge Facciola's speech on this. You can read what Jason had to say about the duty to assist opposing counsel. You can read what I had to say, and everybody, including, by the way, their keynote was none of us. Their keynote was a legend in academic circles called Professor Monroe Freeman. And he is late 70s, very vigorous, known for his controversiality. And he made the point, he started to getting into the ethics of metadata, and he thinks that you have a duty to try and find out what your opposing counsel's metadata is in emails and correspondence they send you, in spite of the fact that many state bar associations say it's unethical. Professor Freeman takes the controversial view that it's that you have a duty to mine metadata, and so that's also in the transcript. Very fascinating discussion about that. And in fact, I got into a big argument with Professor Freeman about that, as I don't think that's proper to do in when you're talking about correspondence between lawyers. But he has a strong position saying that it's in fact a duty to your client to try and do that.
Is Professor Freeman an attorney as well, or just an academic?
Oh, boy, they hate it when you say just an academic. But, he is an attorney. As a matter of fact, he represents lawyers that get in trouble with bar associations. And he's written several textbooks on the ethics of law, and he's a guy that you might be retaining if you had a problem ethically in front of a state board. So, he does practice law, very controversial. One of the judges in Judge Facciola remembers it because he was there in Washington, who later became a Supreme Court justice, and I can't remember which one it was, but shortly before he became a Supreme Court justice, he was on a campaign to have Professor Monroe Freeman disbarred because he was controversial back in the 60s and 70s as well. Yeah, he survived, and it's quite entertaining to read what he had to say and the rest of us. So look out for that, the Mercer Law Review with the full transcript. Okay. I'll probably blog about that or Twitter about it or something to let people know, because I think it's interesting to hear this kind of discussion. Believe me, no punches were pulled on discussing where the duties lie. So anyway, I wrote this law review article called The Wicked Quadrant that will also be included in the publication. And, you know, I'm honored to be in there with Judge Facciola and Professor Freeman and Jason and all of that with my theories about the Wicked Quadrant. And I won't go into the details, but I will just tell you what the four elements of the quadrant are. And then, I'll kind of go into a more popular way of explaining that, which is focusing on the rules that you and I have talked about before.
Yep.
Which is kind of, by the way, my favorite topic of speech now about e-discovery is to approach it from an ethics point of view, because I find there's a lot of resonance and understanding among the general bar, non-specialists in e-discovery. They get ethics, and, you know, they get the duty of legal competence, and they know really that's the fundamental challenge that we're talking there, and that's one of the four sections of the quadrant, is that we all have a duty to keep up. We have a duty to learn the new law, and like it or not, part of that is in litigation is e-discovery, and so we've got to take the time to train ourselves and to be competent in this field, and the fact that the bar as a whole is not really doing that is one of the problems, and leads to this appearance of impropriety. A lot of it is just the only impropriety is they didn't know what they were doing and they were making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it may look like intentional bad faith, but actually they're just screwing up because they didn't know any better.
Yeah, you know, I found that in law. I mean, if you think back to when you started as a lawyer, this is where when I was reading this, what I first thought about. I remember as a first-year summer associate at a downtown law firm being asked to research something, and it was almost as if everything I learned in legal writing disappeared from my mind. I walked into the library, and I thought, what do I do? And I must have killed a lot of time. I didn't want to tell anyone. I didn't know how to start it. And, you know, I got through the project, but it was it's almost like you're not rewarded, or there's this fear of saying, I don't understand this, you know, when it's the first time you try something. And you know, I don't know if it's the way lawyers are rewarded. You know, I've often heard making partners a lot about never screwing up. So, anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt
you. No, it's, you know, when I got out of law school, the UCC had just been enacted a couple of years before, and none of the older lawyers knew the UCC, and it was a tremendous opportunity for young lawyers to make a contribution immediately. And that's the same situation we're in now. And, you know, you and I did the show before on education, so you've heard me talk about this before. The young lawyers just getting out of law school now or just starting practice, there's a tremendous opportunity for you to, if you can get the competence necessary, because a lot of the older attorneys, the ones that are my age, they're just not going to take the time, and it's just inherently difficult for them, and primarily because, and I started thinking about it, it's more than just a question of legal competence, it's also a question of technology competence.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that has more to do with it, and is a key part of the quadrant, the four factors to understand why lawyers are screwing up and behaving badly, is because they're just overwhelmed by the technology. And most lawyers don't get it. They don't understand Facebook. They don't really understand how email works, how deletion works. They don't know what double deletion means. There's just a lot of things that are confusing to them. And this technology incompetence, you know, leads them to do dumb things in cases like, say, oh, yeah, we'll review that backup tape and produce the relevant emails to you next week, Your Honor, when of course, they have no clue that there's 10 million emails on that backup tape. They don't know really what they're talking about. So that's a big part of the explanation, is that we're in an unprecedented explosion in technological advances. And so just a lot of us lawyers are having trouble keeping up with the ever-changing information revolution. So that's another part of the quadrant. And then just real quickly, the other two quadrant sectors are the ethics, and we'll get into this in a minute, rules where you restrain the advocacy and the duty you have to the court to tell the truth and the duty you have to opposing counsel to cooperate with each other. That hasn't been getting enough attention among lawyers until very recently with Sedona and Judge Grimm in the cooperation proclamation. It really had become undershadowed by that other very popular duty to your client to have advocacy and to vigorously advocate on your client's behalf. That sort of got out of hand, and that's the other part of the explanation, because this is the kind of thing clients, they understand and see when you are shouting on their behalf, and they may reward that financially, but they don't understand why it is that you may have a duty to disclose email that's going to hurt their case, and you have a duty to cooperate, so that gets less financial reward. So I kind of get into the economics involved in all of this as well. And again, I don't want to get into too much detail except to say the law review is coming out soon.
Uh-huh.
And if you have my second book, the one Introduction to E-Discovery, Chapter 6 begins with a version, the earlier version of what later became the full law review article. I think it goes quite a bit from page 385 all the way to 404. So it's a fairly long exposition of it. And then I get into, in the book, all the lessons of Qualcomm, which, of course, is the big, you know, we've gone this long without talking about it, but it is the big e-discovery case of the decade, and let's hope there aren't any cases worse than Qualcomm.
Yep, that's true. All right, well, let's go through some of the rules here. Rule 1.1 of competence of the ABA model rules professional conduct says a lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Competent representation requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. Okay, how do we get in trouble here with ethics and e-discovery?
This is the core problem, and this is, you know, why we need to, the problem is this isn't taught in 95% of the law schools, so they're coming out of law school with no information on it, on e-discovery competence. And in most law firms, except for a very few, typically the larger law firms, in most law firms, there are no e-discovery lawyers that have done this for years and have gained competence in it one way or the other. So people are all sort of floundering around, which is why your radio show is so important and other educational efforts like that. People, you know, they need the information out there. It's why CLEs for e-discovery continue to be filled even in these rough economic times. People understand that they need to learn this because the whole notion of discovery, it's now all e-discovery. I mean, very few writings are created on paper. So, you know, I think 98-99% of our writings today are electronically generated. Some of them are printed out, but a relatively small percentage. And usually the hottest information to any case is going to be the inadvertent information in the electronic mails, the text messages, the instant messages, that sort of thing, where people are still saying, you know, incredibly dumb things. So to ignore electronic information is to ignore writings, and you just can't conduct litigation in a competent manner and not look at all of your writings, not look at the original electronic versions of writings instead of just relying upon, you know, what the client may happen to print out and say, here, take a look at this. One of my favorite cases I like to talk about, maybe because it's a Florida case and not everyone knows about it, but is Martin B. Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company. That's a 2006 Westlaw case, 148991, Middle District of Florida, plaintiff's attorney, he was suing for disability benefits. he produced a paper that his client, he was representing another plaintiff's attorney, kind of maybe one reason I like it, as having done a lot of defense work myself, and they produced paper documents, and they said, that's all we got. Those are all the writings we have. Then the insurance company, Northwestern Mutual, eventually proved that that was wrong and eventually found that they had several hundred thousand pages of email and other records that weren't produced. And so they're called in front of the magistrate on a sanctions motion. And this is the plaintiff's excuse was, you know, I'm sorry, Judge, but me and my client were both computer illiterate. We didn't really know how to get to that sort of stuff. Believe me, this excuse has been used for a long time in courts. It's still used today in state courts all over the country. But in federal court, and when he did it in 2006, the response of Judge Pizzo was to call that, frankly, ludicrous. That's a quote. Mm. Judges don't usually call what counsel says ludicrous. Here they did in the writing. Sanctions were imposed against them. And this is, I think, the death knell of this whole, gee, Judge, I didn't know, as a valid way to avoid doing your job and finding the writings, even though they haven't been printed out. And this is what I think you're going to find in every federal court in the country now. They're just not going to put up with this excuse of, I didn't know how to do it. Although, honestly, we all know it still goes on at state court, but it's only a matter of time before the state courts won't put up with it either.
You know, drilling just a little bit deeper into the competence area, because there's just so many areas where this can come up. The podcast that you blogged a little bit about I did with Judge Facciola and Tom French, we got into the economics, and this is going to cost a little bit of money sometimes to do this. And Tom French on the plaintiff's side said, well, if you can't afford it, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, he came right out and said that's an ethical obligation that you have as the lawyers not to take the case if you can't afford to do it right and then look at the data, which I thought was an interesting thought. I hadn't really thought about too much, to tell you the truth.
That's a rare breath of fresh air and honesty, but you know, a lot of plaintiff's lawyers don't look at it that way. A lot of defense lawyers don't look at it that way. In fact, what we've seen, this is me getting controversial here for a minute. We've seen lawyers advocate their responsibility to vendors. Now, I know you work for a vendor too, so you've seen it, but you don't have to give, you don't have to make any comments. But, you know, rather than their figuring out how to do it, they'll hire somebody else to do it. And these vendors will end up making a lot of legal decisions. And the lawyers don't really have a clue what they're doing. Now, your company is, I know, one of the good ones, and they're honest, but you and I know that they're not all like that, and that vendors are in business to make money. And so what they end up doing is over-review. They look at too many documents, and they're really not keeping the expenses down because it's not in their best interest to do so. So I think that's one of the real reasons e-discovery is too expensive, is that lawyers don't know how to do it right, and so they over-delegate it to vendors that don't have the same motivation as a lawyer might to save the client money.
One other area of competence I'd want your thoughts on a little bit is you mentioned the split between large and mid-sized law firms, between those who have e-discovery groups or, you know, focused lawyers that understand the areas that don't. Isn't it also a battle even with the structure, say you've done it right and you have that competence established, to get every lawyer to pick up the phone when they have a matter and say, hey, I may have an issue here?
Yeah, it's a real educational challenge. The large firms, like my firm, we have the advantage in that, you know, we can have a few people become an expert in it, but then we have the disadvantage of having literally hundreds of litigation lawyers and training them to pick up the phone and do that. That just takes time because can you teach an old dog new tricks? Yes, you can, but it takes a lot of effort. Litigators are used to doing discovery on their own, and it's a hard shock for them to realize that there may be part of discovery they can't handle, and that they don't like to admit that, but slowly they will start to admit that. in, you know, a very good firm, Reed Smith, 1,500 lawyers. They have some excellent e-discovery lawyers. And yet in the Bray and Gillespie, the Lexington insurance case, just this March, the law firm itself was sanctioned. And it was sanctioned by the actions of two of its attorneys, shareholders down here. It was in an Orlando District Court case. And it's not because they didn't have the resources. It's because they didn't ask for the help. They just did it on their own. But this is the wake-up call. The Bray and Gillespie case, I think, is a huge wake-up call for law firms to start imposing some discipline and making sure that companies, larger firms, actually use the resources that they're given. The citation for that, by the way, is 2009 Westlaw 546-429, Middle District, Florida, March 4th, 2009, Bray, B-R-A-Y, and Gillespie. I think that's a very important case now. I know my good friend Browning Marion, DLA Piper, thinks this case is more important than the Qualcomm case because it sends a message to the law firms themselves that you've got to make sure that the knowledge is actually being used, because we're just not going to tolerate the kind of activity that happened in Bray and Gillespie and others, which were, just in the judge's view, at least in Bray and Gillespie, a clear violation of the rules of what's required in the format production.
Okay, let's go to another rule here, another of the client duty rules, diligence. Rule 1.3 on diligence says a lawyer shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. How do we get in trouble here in e-discovery with ethics?
Well, it's a big one. And, I got to credit New Jersey and their local rules for coming up with this many years ago when New Jersey put in their local rules that counsel needs to talk right away with the IT department of the client to make sure that preservation holds are properly implemented, the auto-deletion functions are turned off, and the New Jersey rule also suggested that the counsel appearing in cases in New Jersey needs to talk right away with the key custodians in a case about their making sure that evidence is preserved. And then Judge Shinlin in Zuba Lake, in her opinion in 2004, picked up on that theme out of New Jersey, and she created what I and others are now calling the Zuba Lake duty. You'll see that written about in my blog and in my books and stuff, where in her words, she says outside counsel are required, quote, to make certain that all potentially relevant information are identified and placed on hold, end quote. So she's actually putting that duty on outside counsel, not just the client, but on outside counsel to make sure that the relevant information has been placed on hold. So this is, you know, controversial to many people that think, you know, this shouldn't be a lawyer's job. Diligence shouldn't include requiring that the attorney place everything on hold, but in the Zuba Lake duty, you are at least required to have the conversations and to give the advice. Now, if the client doesn't follow your advice, you're probably not going to be sanctioned for that, but on the other hand, you may be in a Qualcomm situation where if the client just blatantly doesn't follow your advice, and by the way, I've never seen this happen to me, but in theory, it could happen, then what you're supposed to do is withdraw, because you're not supposed to condone evidence being deleted. And if you don't have this kind of due diligence to follow up with the client and tell them about their duties, talk to their IT people, explain what they have to do to make sure that relevant evidence isn't deleted. And this all happens, what makes it so darn challenging is this all happens within the first 30 days of a lawsuit. You know, this is stuff that has to be done immediately. And it has to be done in the first few days sometimes to make sure you're stopping the deletion of email. So this is another big duty of diligence has become a big challenge, particularly in e-discovery in connection with preservation.
You know, I almost feel like I should stop for a fictitious sponsor statement here. I had back a couple of years ago, came up with a bottle of wine tied in the Zuba Lake called the Fourth Sea. And there were three seas in Zuba Lake. Jim Daly, a good friend of mine, called it the Zen of Zuba Lake. You have to communicate, to your IT people. You got to coordinate, the stopping, the learning, et cetera, and then you got to comply with the order. And when you mess those up, there's always Cabernet, which was my fourth C. And we got Judge Zuba Lake and Laura Zuba Lake to autograph the bottle. Used to bring them around the conferences. And I still think there's a role as a tool for a good bottle of wine in e-discovery. Calm everyone down. But
Zuba Lake's kind of old news. Okay, it was 5 years ago this came out. But unfortunately, the problem is still there. It's still a huge challenge. And I would like to mention a more recent case, though, one that just came out, and that's the Van Alstyne, V-A-N-A-L-S-T-Y-N-E, Van Alstyne versus Electronic Scriptorium. Great name for a defendant, huh? This is a Fourth Circuit case. So now we're talking an appellate circuit case, which came out on March 18th. And what's interesting about this is the attorney here just took emails that were given to him from his client without doing the diligence of where'd you get those emails? How is it you came to have the emails of this employee who is suing us now? Because they were very personal, private emails. And he didn't really do the diligence required to find out, at least I assume he didn't, and there's no indication in the case to indicate that he knew that these emails were, in effect, hacked from the employee's private online account. And this is a crime, and it subjected defendant company to punitive damages award, even though there was no proof of any actual damages from having the employee's private email hacked into. Because we all know, there the client was being, way too diligent. He figured out a way to get into the Yahoo account. He knew, figured out her username and password, and he stole her email and then just turned it over to his attorney, who blithely said, oh, okay, and used it as surprise on a cross-examination of her deposition. So this is, it's something you've got to understand the evidence and know where it's coming from. And this is just a different kind of example where the attorney didn't do his homework and, in fact, ended up using evidence that was procured in a criminal manner.
All right. That's it's scary stuff, and I've actually encountered something similar. When you know e-discovery well, you sometimes have friends that ask you questions, and in the world of small business, lots of bad things can happen. so your diligence is right.
It is, and those of us that have been around, we know it's not that hard really to hack into somebody's email account, but don't do it and don't let your client do it. There's laws governing these things that need to restrain lawyers as well.
Yeah. Well, let's go into Rule 1.6, confidentiality of information. This falls on the professional duty side of the equation. A lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client unless the client gives informed consent. The disclosure is impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation, or the disclosure is permitted by paragraph B. How do we get in trouble here?
Yeah, there's two things that are really hyper about that. One is, we haven't talked about the duty of cooperation yet, but it kind of dovetails in with this duty of cooperation, particularly in e-discovery, where sometimes we're going to have to disclose to opposing counsel things that we used to keep secret as work product. Used to be kept confidential how you would do your searches. The keywords that you might use to search through your own client's data, that typically was something you just wouldn't share with the other side. None of their business. That's my work product. I'm going to keep it confidential. So that's part of it. And I'll explain, they both kind of dovetail into the Victor Stanley case. But the other thing is the duty not to be producing to the other side attorney-client communications. It's the client's privilege, as you know, to keep things secret. And the client typically instructs you, the lawyer, don't turn over our secret emails to each other. I don't want to waive that privilege. I don't want the person who sued me, for instance, to see what we've been talking about in connection with this case or in connection with anything. So part of e-discovery, one of the most expensive parts of e-discovery, is to review documents that have already been found to be relevant and to remove from those documents the attorney-client communications, things that are protected by attorney-client privilege or all other kinds of privilege, and then also to review and protect documents that are confidential, that might just be trade secrets of your client, and to protect them in various manners. But focusing in on the duty to keep the communications between an attorney and their client secret, which is really what this ethical duty is talking about, very, very important duty. This all kind of came to head in the Victor Stanley v. Creative Pipe case that everybody that's an e-discovery junkie knows this one by Magistrate Judge Paul Grimm. It was decided almost a year ago now, May 29th, 2008. If you haven't seen it, you'll find it discussed in my books and also in the blog. And it had to do with the also pertained to the reasonable diligence requirement in that the people doing that final review of relevant documents to remove privilege, they missed over 300 privileged documents and they went and produced them to the other side. And so their duty to keep things confidential was breached. And at that point, they were invited to explain to the court and the other side whether they conducted a reasonable search. And if they were able to prove a reasonable search, they might be able to prevent the privilege from having been waived. And that's where that confidentiality, they then reared their ugly head on that and said, nope, we're not going to tell you what our search terms were. That's our work product. We're keeping that confidential. We're not revealing it. And so based with that scenario where 300 documents were produced and they claim it was accidental, but they wouldn't explain what they did to try and catch him at all. The Judge Grimm found that there was a waiver of the privilege, and because he did not find that there had been a quality assurance testing program, basically he didn't find that what they'd done was reasonable to try and protect the confidentiality of their client's information. So that was a duty on the shoulders of the attorney, which they didn't discharge, and here it cost the client the loss of their privilege.
I should throw a little plug in there. I haven't set the date yet, but Judge Grimm's agreed to do a podcast. I'm talking to one other judge. I want to do something on sort of from a 10,000-foot level search and retrieval from the judge's perspective. So I'll keep you updated on that.
Well, yeah, having Judge Grimm talk about it would be great. You know, Rule 502, the new evidence code, has addressed some of these problems to a degree and maybe taken some of the pressure off us, but it is still, I think, one of the fundamental problems we have in e-discovery, and that is doing an affordable privilege review to try and catch these things. And, you know, I'm sure you'll have other shows just dealing with Rule 502, because that is a big help.
Okay, Rule 3.2, expediting litigation, is another rule that you thrown into the cocktail mix here. A lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to expedite litigation consistent with the interests of the client. How does that relate to e-discovery?
It's key. I mean, that's the core ethics rule behind the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation, which, if you haven't heard of it, go to the SedonaConference.org website, download it, and read it. It's being signed on to by judges everywhere. It is also, speaking of Judge Grimm again, was the core message in his case, Mancia v. Mayflower Textile Services, which came out October of last year, another key case to understand on this whole business of keeping the cost of e-discovery down, which is a core problem. And part of the reason the e-discovery costs get out of control is people lose track of this ethical duty we have to move things along. That really is in the interest of your client. Let's stipulate to things. Let's have more transparency and cooperation. Let's stop this old game of hide the ball. You know, it's never been ethically allowed, but we all know it's gone on for years and years. And maybe in the paper world where people were competent, that wouldn't blow the client's budget out of the water. But nowadays, when you start playing hide the ball and start playing games in e-discovery and start trying to be obstructionist, when you start filing boilerplate objections to everything and you don't cooperate, before you know it, you're going to have the tail wagging the dog. You're going to have e-discovery be the most important part of your case, and it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars, just to get involved in sorting out the e-discovery quagmire and the confusion and the disputes. That's not what litigation is about. Litigation is about the merits of the case. Discovery is just a way to get to the truth to then argue about the merits. So my message and message of Sedona Conference is, let's cooperate on getting the information on the table. Let's stop trying to play games and one-upmanship and fighting over that. Let's then fight on what the facts mean. Let's fight on what the law is. There's plenty of room for arguments and disputes, but let's not fight over what should the format of production be, metadata this, metadata that. I mean, most of these arguments that I see in cases are totally unnecessary and have just run up a bill needlessly on the clients. And it's a case of they think they're being a vigorous advocate, but really they're not. And they've lost track of their duty to move things along, which is, by the way, federal rule of procedure, rule number one, quick, inexpensive adjudication. That's what we need to be doing. And e-discovery has got to stop being the whipping boy against this. And we've got to start. And the way to do it is by cooperating, which is why I'm such a strong believer in what Sedona is doing in that area.
Yeah, we did a show with Richard Brayman, who heads the Sedona Conference, on the cooperation proclamation. It's interesting stuff and certainly critical.
You know, I hear some people say, oh, well, that's wimpy. You know, you're not. The truth of the matter is, this is not just rolling over and giving what the other side wants. This is mutual cooperation. This is strategic cooperation to benefit your client. You know, you got to pick your battles, and one of your battles shouldn't be over e-discovery. Your battle should be on the merits of the case. So, I mean, the people that think that this is just a mistake to cooperate, they're not really getting it, and they're part of the problem to running up the cost of e-discovery. And so, you know, this is something that we all have to kind of move beyond our old mindset. There's nothing wrong with cooperating, and in fact, the ethics and the rules require it.
We did a really nice show with Arianna Tadler last week on from the plaintiff perspective. She's a prominent lawyer at Milberg and one of the few really well-known e-discovery experts on that side. And she talked about the meet and confer, about how she goes in with letters and what we're looking for, and sort of an olive branch, essentially, to try to get the case going the right way. But it's tempered with healthy skepticism at the same time, you know, because it doesn't work all the time that way. And the cases where it works are far better, she said, in terms for both sides.
Well, I always say it takes two to tango. And, you know, if one side won't cooperate, that doesn't mean that you give and all they do is take. If they don't give back and don't cooperate, you've got one clear solution. You go to the judge, and you go to the judge quickly and right away. And that's what all the judges say they want. So, you know, if you get one side that won't cooperate with you, you do your best, you make your paper record, you make it clear you're wearing the white hat, and you take it to the judge. And you're going to find out those judges are going to insist on cooperation. There's no tolerance in the federal bench for this at all.
Well, that's a good lead into the next rule, candor to the toward the tribunal, Rule 3.3, which says in various parts and subparts, a lawyer shall not knowingly, 1, make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal, or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer, .. or 3, offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false, .. So those are key to your position in this area. How does that impact e-discovery, Ralph?
Well, we'll come back to Qualcomm again, because that Qualcomm is bigger than Zuba Lake at this point. It is the lesson case for the legal profession at large, happens to be in e-discovery, and it's ongoing. Although Qualcomm and Broadcom settled their series of lawsuits they had all over the country, they finally settled that just a few weeks ago for a big ticket being written from Qualcomm to Broadcom. But nevertheless, the lawsuit in the San Diego District Court, even though it's over and the jury ruled against Qualcomm over a year ago now, but it continues for the question of what kind of sanctions are appropriate against the outside counsel who represented Qualcomm. And there will be a trial on this, we're told, later this year, probably near the end of 2009, where the trial is going to be to assess the blame. Who's to blame for false statements being made to the judge, to the jury, to the opposing counsel about email of Qualcomm, about the denial that was made by Qualcomm from the moment they filed suit that they had any information concerning their cooperation in this organization, technical organization, concerning their patent. And they basically tried to hide the elephant. They responded to requests for production on numerous occasions by saying, no, we don't have any responsive email concerning this. They had deposition testimony in advance of trial where everybody towed the party line. Nope, we didn't do this, we didn't do that. And then it turned out one honest witness at trial, into like the second week of trial, said, oh, yes, I think there was an email or two on that. I happen to remember a couple. And because of that one honest witness, the jury, by the way, ruled against Qualcomm very quickly after that. And after the case was over, though, because of that testimony, which was contrary to all the representations that had been made by Qualcomm during the trial, the district court judge said, I want a hearing and I want to find out, was there intentional misrepresentations made by lawyers to the court, made to the jury, made to opposing counsel? And that's what triggered this investigation into the conduct where, in the judge's words, the judge is convinced that he was lied to at a sidebar conference during trial. The judges are convinced that the lawyers did try to hide evidence and were not truthful. And so this is the core thing. The judges have to understand and they have to be confident that when lawyers tell them things, it's the truth. If they can't trust the lawyers to tell them the truth, who can they trust? And that is the highest duty that we lawyers have, is to be honest to the judges. And when you don't do that, you know, you deserve the rebukes, you deserve the sanctions, you deserve the ethical things. This is the core value, and that is telling the truth. Lawyers telling the truth to judges, lawyers telling the truth to each other, and being honest in their discovery. And that's why this is a core message for litigation across the board, is that we're not going to, our system of justice won't work if people are lying. Now, litigants may lie. There's perjury for that. Maybe, you know, that happens. But lawyers should never lie. And that's basically what this rule is about. That's what Qualcomm's about.
Okay, let's go into the final rule that we'll discuss on this, Rule 3.4, which is fairness to opposing party and counsel. And we've touched a little on this. But a lawyer shall not, A, unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or unlawfully alter, destroy, or conceal a document or other material having potential evidentiary value. A lawyer shall not counsel or assist another person to do any such act. And then in Part D, in pretrial procedure, make a frivolous discovery request or fail to make reasonably diligent effort to comply with a legally proper discovery request by an opposing party, ... So how does that play into this issue, Ralph?
Well, we've already kind of talked about it. This is the duty to cooperate. This is the Mancia case of Judge Grimm. This is more of the ethical underpinning of why it is you need to cooperate. You're required by ethics, by being a lawyer, you're required to cooperate on this level. And unfortunately, we still see this happening time and time again when lawyers are not discharging their professional duties. Another case, not as well known, but I would point to the listeners to, that demonstrates a non-cooperation, not following this, is called U and I, the letter U and letter I, U and I Corporation versus Advanced Medical Design. That's 2008 Westlaw 821993. Again, this is one coming out of Florida, so I happen to know about it, March 26th, 2008. This is an important case because it shows how a defendant can insist on cooperation from the plaintiff that was suing them here, and when they don't, to get sanctions when they don't cooperate. Just a one brief quote from a magistrate, Judge Elizabeth Jenkins, who says, quote, "It is not the court's role nor that of opposing counsel to drag a party kicking and screaming through the discovery process." I think that's an important quote. You know, if you can show that to the judge, that that's what you have to do because they're not cooperating, they're not being forthright, they're basically fighting you every inch of the way, you will get relief. You apply to the court for relief, cite to the UNI Corporation case, cite to Mancia, point out the duty to cooperate, and you can stop this because, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people didn't get the cooperation memo. And the real world is that most people are still not cooperating. So that's why it's important to know about these ethical requirements, know about these cases where lawyers are having their hands slapped when they don't fulfill their duties.
How do these, I mean, you know, there are these six rules, and I really like your quadrant. I'm going to attach your blog on your description and the description of the show so that people can link to it. But how do these rules sort of compete with each other? I mean, who wins, the client or the professional duties?
Yeah, I mean, they have to be brought into balance, and because a client doesn't really win when a lawyer is fighting over everything with opposing counsel. Now, the client might at first get a few rah-rahs out of that. Oh, boy, yeah, he's fighting for my side. But you know what? After he starts getting the bills for this month after month, year after year, it stops being so exciting to the client. And we all know that that's not really in the client's best interest to be fighting over everything. That kind of vigorous advocacy is something that even the biggest corporations can't afford. They need to cooperate. So, I mean, the client will win. That's the point of all of this. This is, you know, the legal profession, we're here to represent parties that are in disputes, to give them legal advice. And so the winner on all of this is always got to be the client by following the ethics. That's what this is designed. The ethic duties are designed to improve and maintain the quality of our system of justice. And the system of justice is not there for lawyers. It's not there so we'll have a job. It's there so that justice will be done. So, you know, that's getting on the pulpit for a little bit. The winner is always going to be the people that as opposed to the old days of, you know, trying to do it through violence or self-help, that they turn to a system where the truth will come out and just results will be attained. That's what we're all here. That's what the goal of everyone is. So I think that will be who the winner is once we start following the rules of ethics that have that end game goal in mind.
That was as good an answer as I could have expected from that poorly framed question. I'm almost thinking of my ethics class in law school, and Judge Wettick here in Pennsylvania, he's a well-known state court judge here, teaches it, and you know, he would take one side or the other, and we'd only attack one rule at a time. I threw six of them at you. Almost impossible, but you're right. I mean, this is a balancing act, but really, there are some solutions in here, and let's try to hit on a couple of these solutions. Try to wrap this up into a couple of tips for the listeners.
Yeah, we might as well end on practical, positive stuff. And right now, I'm talking about a threefold solution,
mm-hmm.
trying to keep it simple. So number one is e-discovery teams. That's why I call my blog an e-discovery team. And the message there is that lawyers, techs, and management need to all work together as a team. That's part of the way to overcome the competence problem is get a tech not, you know, tied to the hip, as Craig Ball likes to say he wants to avoid, but get a tech on your team. Learn to collaborate. Stop being the, you know, Perry Mason, he used a detective. Today's lawyer needs to have a tech. They need to have a geek that they can work with. So that's part of the solution is form an interdisciplinary team. Number one, that's number one. Number two is cooperation and be transparent in what you're doing. Cooperate with the other side. Fulfill your duty of disclosure. Take that seriously. Save the arguments for the law. We've already talked about that, but that is a second core solution. And then the third part we haven't talked about, but that's what I call calibration and metrics, which includes using the new technology, using the latest methods in order to tackle the needle in the haystack search problem and to keep track of your information and manage it better. This is the kind of thing that Jason Barron and the Trek Legal Track addresses. He's coming out with a new paper, Sedona is, I think, within the next week or two, on quality control and metrics, which I'll blog about that when it comes out. I've had some hand in that with Jason and Sedona, and I think it's an excellent guide to help people on this use of calibration and numerics and metrics as part of search. It's all, a lot of groups are working on this. I was just presenting with George Socia. The EDRM group now has an EDRM search guide available on their website, which provides more information about calibration metrics, how to do sampling, and that type of thing. So there's a lot of ways to get information on this subject, and I would urge all your listeners to learn a little bit more about how to do quality control, how to do metrics, and to basically use numbers as your friend to keep the price of e-discovery down.
Yeah, we're doing a show coming up with another one of those people who's in that group. Herb Roblate is going to be doing a show, and Ann Kershaw and Patrick Ood are also talking about doing a show on this. So there's no shortage of people that are studying this that are willing to provide some information.
Thank you for mentioning them. That's the other group, Ann's group, eDiscovery Institute. That to me is the core problem, and the solution to it is just using statistics and sampling and just getting a more disciplined handle on how much we actually review. In other words, how to cull down things a lot. So that's the third prong of the solution. You know, use teams, cooperate, and figure out how to do search better by using some sort of a metric analysis.
I don't get to say this very often, but that's what brought me back into the field, was focusing in on that specific issue. It's just, if you've lived off of the other model, which is throwing lots of bodies at the problem, you just realize how inefficient it is. And then when you study the studies, Blair Maron, case, and anyone that's looked at sort of brute force based on people, it doesn't work. And it's very, very expensive. There are tools out there. It's really fascinating, and it ties right back into your first thread about people learning new skills, working together as a team. It's interesting how this all fits together.
So, well, thank you for having me on the show,
and
thank you to all the listeners for having the patience to hang in there. I know we went on and on, but it's important stuff, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk to you about it.
It is great. Thanks again, Ralph. And for those who want to see a complete list of shows, go to www.esibytes.com. What we say here at the show is come to ESI Bytes to learn more about electronic discovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again, Ralph.
All right. Goodbye.
Take care. Bye-bye.